Listening test. Task 1. You are going to listen to an interview about the similarities between rock music and the U.S. economy. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 7, with the sentence endings, A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
President Obama's economic advisor, Alan Krueger, has studied the ways technology has transformed another key industry. Mr. Krueger, who will soon be leaving Washington, D.C. to return to his old job teaching economics at Princeton, took some ribbing from his boss this week.
And now that Alan has some free time, he can return to another burning passion of his, rockonomics. The economics of rock and roll. This is something that Alan actually cares about.
In fact, Mr. Krueger gave a speech this week at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, where he said, the music business offers valuable lessons about the broader U.S. economy, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Krueger titled his speech, Land of Hope and Dreams, in honor of his fellow New Jersey native, Bruce Springsteen. Springsteen boasted the second highest grossing concert tour last year, right behind Madonna, with 72 shows that together raked in more than $199 million. That makes The Boss a fitting emblem of our modern superstar economy. In music, as in so many industries, Krueger says, the lion's share of the money now goes to a relative handful of top performers.
The lucky and the talented, and it is often hard to tell the difference, have been doing better and better, while the vast majority has struggled to keep up.
Economists point to a variety of explanations for that growing concentration of income, technology, globalization, and Krueger highlights that role of luck, noting that for every superstar, there are other equally talented performers who don't catch the same breaks. He notes that Columbia Records almost passed on the hit single that Rolling Stone later called the greatest rock and roll song ever. Lucky for us, Bob Dylan's six-minute opus was released, and thanks to modern recording technology, Dylan was able to reach a worldwide audience. More recently, of course, technology has upended the music business, depressing album sales so artists depend more on concerts to make money. Krueger says that's a big reason concert tickets have gotten more expensive. But as every good scalper knows, many artists still don't charge as much as they could for fear of breaking an implicit bargain with their fans.
Along these lines, Tom Petty once said, I don't see how carving out the best seats and charging a lot more for them has anything to do with rock and roll. And I won't
back down. Krueger says for much of the last century, the whole U.S. economy was governed by a similar social compact, the idea that economic gains should be widely shared. Krueger argues that was reinforced in the decades after World War II by a progressive tax system, labor unions, and a rising minimum wage.
Now, I'll argue that that social compact was good for business and it was good for the economy. But the social compact began to fray in the 1980s.
Since then, top earners have seen their incomes skyrocket, while the middle class has been treading water, and those at the bottom of the income ladder have actually fallen a few rungs. Not surprisingly, as an advisor in a Democratic White House, Krueger advocates policies designed to mitigate that trend. He says a stronger middle class would not only fuel more economic growth, but also promote more equal opportunity.
President Obama's economic advisor, Alan Krueger, has studied the ways technology has transformed another key industry. Mr. Krueger, who will soon be leaving Washington, D.C. to return to his old job teaching economics at Princeton, took some ribbing from his boss this week.
And now that Alan has some free time, he can return to another burning passion of his, rockonomics, the economics of rock and roll. This is something that Alan actually cares about.
In fact, Mr. Krueger gave a speech this week at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, where he said the music business offers valuable lessons about the broader U.S. economy, and NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Krueger titled his speech Land of Hope and Dreams in honor of his fellow New Jersey native, Bruce Springsteen. Springsteen boasted the second highest grossing concert tour last year, right behind Madonna, with 72 shows that together raked in more than $199 million. That makes The Boss a fitting emblem of our modern superstar economy. In music, as in so many industries, Krueger says, the lion's share of the money now goes to a relative handful of top performers.
The lucky and the talented, and it is often hard to tell the difference, have been doing better and better, while the vast majority has struggled to keep up.
Economists point to a variety of explanations for that growing concentration of income, technology, globalization, and Krueger highlights that role of luck, noting that for every superstar, there are other equally talented performers who don't catch the same breaks. He notes that Columbia Records almost passed on the hit single that Rolling Stone later called the greatest rock and roll song ever. Like a rolling stone. Lucky for us, Bob Dylan's six-minute opus was released, and thanks to modern recording technology, Dylan was able to reach a worldwide audience. More recently, of course, technology has upended the music business, depressing album sales so artists depend more on concerts to make money. Krueger says that's a big reason concert tickets have gotten more expensive. But as every good scalper knows, many artists still don't charge as much as they could for fear of breaking an implicit bargain with their fans.
Along these lines, Tom Petty once said, "I don't see how carving out the best seats and charging a lot more for them has anything to do with rock and roll." And I won't
back down. Krueger says for much of the last century, the whole U.S. economy was governed by a similar social compact, the idea that economic gains should be widely shared. Krueger argues that was reinforced in the decades after World War II by a progressive tax system, labor unions, and a rising minimum wage.
Now, I'll argue that that social compact was good for business, and it was good for the economy. But the social compact began to fray in the 1980s.
Since then, top earners have seen their income skyrocket, while the middle class has been treading water, and those at the bottom of the income ladder have actually fallen a few rungs. Not surprisingly, as an advisor in a Democratic White House, Krueger advocates policies designed to mitigate that trend. He says a stronger middle class would not only fuel more economic growth, but also promote more equal opportunity.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a woman talking about her fascination with a game you can play on your smartphone. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 7 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
For 2 days last week, I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to read or talk to people. I certainly didn't want to work. All I wanted to do was stare at little squiggles on a screen and guess which logos they represented. It all started when one of my sons shoved his iPhone under my nose and pointed at 2 excessively curly letters in a blue circle. "What's that?" he demanded. "General Electric," I replied in a flash. This was all it took. From that minute, I was a slave to Logos Quiz, a game that for the past couple of weeks has been the most downloaded free app for the iPhone. It starts off gently with images everyone knows, Starbucks, Facebook, and so on, but then gets harder, tantalising you with tiny parts of logos that you know, but can't quite place. There's the rush of joy on realising that a thin white line with a red surround is part of CNN. A further jolt of pleasure comes with seeing that the 2 black S's that have been eluding you are Hugo Boss. If you get stuck, you can ask for a clue or ask on Twitter. I used to wonder what this microblogging site was for. Now I know. It's to disturb as many people as possible and ask them if they can identify the red swan with the circle around it. I'm aware that I ought not to be pushing this electronic form of crack cocaine to Financial Times readers. If you download this thing, you can say goodbye to work for the rest of the day. But still, I urge you to do so. This is no paper toss or super rat the cheese addiction. It's essential for everyone who is even slightly interested in memory or in branding. The first thing you come to realise is how these logos are tattooed on your brain. There was a study done a few years ago showing that toddlers recognise the McDonald's arches before they know their own names. Another, more recent study showed that seeing the golden arches triggers neurological changes that increase our reading speed. It's not called fast food for nothing. I used to think that this was just a McDonald's effect, so was never terribly worried. I despised the soppy columnists who wrote articles about the pernicious brainwashing power of brands. But now I'm not so sure. Take a blue oblong with the corners cut off. Set it at an angle. I looked at this for about half a second before I found myself yelling "Blockbuster" at my iPad. How did that happen? I've never rented a Blockbuster video in my life, or knowingly walked past a store, or seen any advertising. What was the image doing, lurking there so easy to find when other things, the name of a neighbour or the plot of a novel I've read recently, have vanished altogether? Our stock of logos is so ingrained that they've become part of who we are. So much so that we're taken aback when people close to us don't have the same stock. My younger son was floored by the chunky red K on the yellow background, as he'd never heard of Kodak. For 2 days last week, I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to read or talk to people. I certainly didn't want to work. All I wanted to do was stare at little squiggles on a screen and guess which logos they represented. It all started when one of my sons shoved his iPhone under my nose and pointed at two excessively curly letters in a blue circle. "What's that?" he demanded. "General Electric," I replied in a flash. This was all it took. From that minute, I was a slave to Logos Quiz, a game that for the past couple of weeks has been the most downloaded free app for the iPhone. It starts off gently with images everyone knows, Starbucks, Facebook, and so on, but then gets harder, tantalising you with tiny parts of logos that you know but can't quite place. There's the rush of joy on realising that a thin white line with a red surround is part of CNN. A further jolt of pleasure comes with seeing that the two black S's that have been eluding you are Hugo Boss. If you get stuck, you can ask for a clue or ask on Twitter. I used to wonder what this microblogging site was for. Now I know. It's to disturb as many people as possible and ask them if they can identify the red swan with the circle around it. I'm aware that I ought not to be pushing this electronic form of crack cocaine to Financial Times readers. If you download this thing, you can say goodbye to work for the rest of the day. But still, I urge you to do so. This is no paper toss or super rat the cheese addiction. It's essential for everyone who is even slightly interested in memory or in branding. The first thing you come to realise is how these logos are tattooed on your brain. There was a study done a few years ago showing that toddlers recognise the McDonald's arches before they know their own names. Another, more recent study showed that seeing the golden arches triggers neurological changes that increase our reading speed. It's not called fast food for nothing. I used to think that this was just a McDonald's effect, so was never terribly worried. I despised the soppy columnists who wrote articles about the pernicious brainwashing power of brands. But now I'm not so sure. Take a blue oblong with the corners cut off. Set it at an angle. I looked at this for about half a second before I found myself yelling "Blockbuster" at my iPad. How did that happen? I've never rented a Blockbuster video in my life, or knowingly walked past a store, or seen any advertising. What was the image doing, lurking there so easy to find when other things, the name of a neighbour or the plot of a novel I've read recently, have vanished altogether? Our stock of logos is so ingrained that they've become part of who we are. So much so that we're taken aback when people close to us don't have the same stock. My younger son was floored by the chunky red K on the yellow background, as he'd never heard of Kodak.
Task 3. You are going to listen to an interview with Blaine Leonard on the state of American traffic and sewage systems. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
After that I-35 bridge collapse in 2007, it was reported that more than 73,000 bridges around the country were rated structurally deficient by the Federal Highway Administration, and another 80,000 rated functionally obsolete. Well, this week, we heard President Obama propose $50 billion in infrastructure spending to rebuild roads, bridges, and runways, and construct new rail lines.
I am announcing a new plan for rebuilding and modernizing America's roads and rails and runways for the long term. I want America to have the best infrastructure in the world. We used to have the best infrastructure in the world. We can have it again.
We're going to get a report card now on the country's infrastructure from Blaine Leonard. He's president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. Nice to be here.
And if that bridge collapse in 2007 was a big wake-up call to the country, do you think that there's been significant progress made since then?
No, unfortunately, really not. It was a wake-up call. Some people started talking about doing some things, but the fact of the matter is the infrastructure condition continues to decline. Our report card grades the nation's infrastructure at a D, and despite all of the talk that followed the I-35 collapse, we haven't done anything significant to reverse that trend.
Well, you mentioned spending, and of course, part of the stimulus package passed last year was money for infrastructure, maybe $100 billion or so. I feel like as I drive around, I see road signs indicating that the construction project underway is because of the Stimulus Act. How is that money being spent?
The stimulus package was about $787 billion. Somewhere in the neighborhood of about $70 to $100 billion actually went into tangible physical infrastructure. Now, $70 billion is a lot of money, but when you compare that against the shortfall that we have in transportation alone of $550 billion, it helps, but it doesn't get us there. Now, one of the challenges with the stimulus package was a significant portion of that money had to be spent very quickly. And so it quite often didn't go into large projects that take a lot of time to develop and get approved and get bid out. It went for a lot of routine maintenance things, pavement maintenance, for instance. And that was helpful. But it doesn't replace over 100,000 bridges that are structurally deficient or functional obsolete.
One other thing that the White House is proposing, along with this funding for infrastructure, is an infrastructure bank that would combine government spending with private financing. What do you think about that idea?
We applaud that idea. We really have to be creative in figuring out a new way to provide a steady, consistent source of funding for our infrastructure. In the 1960s, we were spending 5% of our gross domestic product on infrastructure. By the 90s, it was 2.5%. Today, it's less than 2%. We need to find better sources of funding and consistent funding.
That earlier period that you're talking about, where there was so much more spending on infrastructure, of course, that was when the highway system was being developed, when there was a whole lot of new building going on, and we're in a different phase now, right?
You're correct. In the 1950s through the 70s, we built an expansive interstate highway system. In the 70s, we built water and sewer treatment. In the late 70s, we built mass transit. And we built an infrastructure that was the envy of all the world. Unfortunately, we then sort of patted ourselves on the back and moved on to some other priorities and enjoyed the value of this great infrastructure. And what we built in the 50s through the 70s is now 30 to 50 years old. And most of it has fallen into disrepair. It's just old and needs to be renovated and replaced. It's time for us to sort of pick up that ball and run with it again.
After that I-35 bridge collapse in 2007, it was reported that more than 73,000 bridges around the country were rated structurally deficient by the Federal Highway Administration, and another 80,000 rated functionally obsolete. Well, this week, we heard President Obama propose $50 billion in infrastructure spending to rebuild roads, bridges, and runways, and construct new rail lines.
I am announcing a new plan for rebuilding and modernizing America's roads and rails and runways for the long term. I want America to have have the best infrastructure in the world. We used to have the best infrastructure in the world. We can have it again.
We're going to get a report card now on the country's infrastructure from Blaine Leonard. He's president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. Nice to be here.
And if that bridge collapse in 2007 was a big wake-up call to the country, do you think that there's been significant progress made since then?
No, unfortunately, really not. It was a wake-up call. Some people started talking about doing some things, but the fact of the matter is the infrastructure condition continues to decline. Our report card grades the nation's infrastructure at a D, and despite all of the talk that followed the I-35 collapse, we haven't done anything significant to reverse that trend.
Well, you mentioned spending, and of course, part of the stimulus package passed last year was money for infrastructure, maybe $100 billion or so. I feel like as I drive around, I see road signs indicating that the construction project underway is because of the Stimulus Act. How is that money being spent?
The stimulus package was about $787 billion. Somewhere in the neighborhood of about $70 to $100 billion actually went into tangible physical infrastructure. Now, $70 billion is a lot of money, but when you compare that against the shortfall that we have in transportation alone of $550 billion, it helps. But it doesn't get us there. Now, one of the challenges with the stimulus package was a significant portion of that money had to be spent very quickly. And so it quite often didn't go into large projects that take a lot of time to develop and get approved and get bid out. It went for a lot of routine maintenance things, pavement maintenance, for instance. And that was helpful. But it doesn't replace over 100,000 bridges that are structurally deficient or functional obsolete.
One other thing that the White House is proposing, along with this funding for infrastructure, is an infrastructure bank that would combine government spending with private financing. What do you think about that idea?
We applaud that idea. We really have to be creative in figuring out a new way to provide a steady, consistent source of funding for our infrastructure. In the 1960s, we were spending 5% of our gross domestic product on infrastructure. By the 90s, it was 2.5%. Today, it's less than 2%. We need to find better sources of funding and consistent funding.
That earlier period that you're talking about, where there was so much more spending on infrastructure, of course, that was when the highway system was being developed, when there was a whole lot of new building going on, and we're in a different phase now, right?
You're correct. In the 1950s through the 70s, we built an expansive interstate highway system. In the 70s, we built water and sewer treatment. In the late 70s, we built mass transit. And we built an infrastructure that was the envy of all the world. Unfortunately, we then sort of patted ourselves on the back and moved on to some other priorities and enjoyed the value of this great infrastructure. And what we built in the 50s through the 70s is now 30 to 50 years old. And most of it has fallen into disrepair. It's just old and needs to be renovated and replaced. It's time for us to sort of pick up that ball and run with it again.
Task 4. You are going to listen to an interview with the general manager of a London five-star hotel, The Milestone. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for questions 1 to 6. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
I'd like to kick off, Andrew, if I may, with asking you, rather challengingly, I suppose, how you see the opportunities and challenges of a five-star property in these difficult times.
I think, Roger, we're probably experiencing some of our most challenging times to date. Various factors. One certainly is the recent security alerts that have been in place for a while now, but it's become obviously very much to the forefront of people's minds. And perhaps the second thing is the continuing issue with the dollar exchange rate, and that's obviously eating into people's pockets. So a lot of our guests are overseas visitors.
Yeah, how many guests are Americans, actually?
We're around about 50% of our guests at the Milestone, so it's quite a big number for us.
So you're trying to keep that clientele, obviously.
Most definitely.
And I would think, you know, try to diversify. Are you having success in that?
Very much so. We are. We've got a fairly strong base of European guests as well. But yes, traditionally, the Milestone has been a strong US hotel for sure. Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to my next question, really, with a mixture of guests, a mixture of nationalities. How do you reconcile different nationalities' needs, requirements, and exigencies, if you will, demands, and also reconcile the business and the leisure traveller?
I think in terms of nationalities, we obviously do recognise that different nationalities may have specific requirements. But I think the view that we take first and foremost is that we like to personalise our service, and we very much do regard people as individuals, and maybe don't get too hooked up on sort of customising in relation to specific nationalities.
Well, people often get confused, I do sometimes, between what is a five-star property and what is a four-star property. And stars vary all over the place, all over the world, really.
Yeah.
And they're not a consistent classification, in my view. But how do you see, what are the characteristics of a five-star hotel?
I think for the five-star level, the basics in terms of quality, comfort, fixtures and fittings, beds that are comfortable, bathrooms that work, that's all a prerequisite for five star. I think what really marks a five star property out about perhaps above any others is really the service. It's down to the individuals, it's down to the staff and the interaction they have with the guests.
How do you maintain good service?
We got to recruit the right people to start with. You've got to recruit people who genuinely love looking after other people. That has to be in place. Then it's really a question of being fair, appreciating the people that are working with you. Great training program. We have one of the most comprehensive training programs for our staff that I think any hotel company has, and that's the key to it.
Do you check them out from time to time with secret shopper, mystery shoppers,
yes,
as they're called?
We're great mystery shoppers. They're very much on our agenda.
Okay, I heard somewhere, and I've been reading, that travellers are now wanting to get back to basics. I mean, in the old days, of course, you had a comfortable bed and a clean towels in the bathroom, etc., etc. Now, hotel bedrooms are like sort of luxury apartments, all the gizmos
indeed. And
things, and Wi-Fi and televisions and multi-channels and that sort of thing. But people are getting back to basics, I think. And, I mean, the main thing is to get a good night's sleep. I'd like to kick off, Andrew, if I may, with asking you, rather challengingly, I suppose, how you see the opportunities and challenges of a five-star property in these difficult times.
I think, Roger, we're probably experiencing some of our most challenging times to date. Various factors. One certainly is the recent security alerts that have been in place for a while now, but it's become obviously very much to the forefront of people's minds. And perhaps the second thing is the continuing issue with the dollar exchange rate, and that's obviously eating into people's pockets. So a lot of our guests are overseas visitors.
Yeah, how many guests are Americans, actually?
We're around about 50% of our guests at the milestone, so it's quite a big number for us.
So you're trying to keep that clientele, obviously.
Most definitely.
And I would think, you know, try to diversify. Are you having success in that?
Very much so. We are. We've got a fairly strong base of European guests as well. But yes, traditionally, the milestone has been a strong US hotel for sure.
Which brings me to my next question, really, with a mixture of guests, a mixture of nationalities. How do you reconcile different nationalities' needs, requirements, and exigencies, if you will, demands, and also reconcile the business and the leisure traveller?
I think in terms of nationalities, we obviously do recognise that different nationalities may have specific requirements. But I think the view that we take first and foremost is that we like to personalise our service, and we very much do regard people as individuals, and maybe don't get too hooked up on sort of customising in relation to specific nationalities.
Well, people often get confused, I do sometimes, between what is a five-star property and what is a four-star property. And stars vary all over the place, all over the world, really.
Yeah.
And they're not a consistent classification, in my view. But how do you see, what are the characteristics of a five-star hotel?
I think for the five-star level, the basics in terms of quality, comfort, fixtures and fittings, beds that are comfortable, bathrooms that work, that's all a prerequisite for five star. I think what really marks a five star property out perhaps above any others is really the service. It's down to the individuals, it's down to the staff and the interaction they have with the guests.
How do you maintain good service?
We got to recruit the right people to start with. You've got to recruit people who genuinely love looking after other people. That has to be in place. Then it's really a question of being fair, appreciating the people that are working with you. Great training program. We have one of the most comprehensive training programs for our staff that I think any hotel company has, and that's the key to it.
Do you check them out from time to time with secret shopper, mystery shoppers,
yes,
as they're called?
We're great mystery shoppers. They're very much on our agenda.
Okay, I heard somewhere, and I've been reading that people are now. Discerning travellers are now wanting to get back to basics. I mean, in the old days, of course, you had a comfortable bed and a clean towels in the bathroom, etc., etc. Now, hotel bedrooms are like sort of luxury apartments, all the gizmos
indeed.
And things, and Wi-Fi and televisions and multi-channels and that sort of thing. But people are getting back to basics, I think. And, I mean, the main thing is to get a good night's sleep.
This is the end of the listening test.